Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we are covering the ratification debates with the Massachusetts debates. We're also supporting Jerry Winstrom's campaign for auditor. It's the statewide campaign in Missouri for the 2026 election. And let me see here. Well, if you've got any questions of what we need to do, hopefully we'll be getting through this content so we can actually dive into the interposition. I think we're doing really well at this point in time content-wise. So anyway, Sean, welcome back.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, happy to have you. As a matter of fact, I always welcome your contributions. And we left off in the Massachusetts debates. And let's look at who the speaker is. This is, let me see, Mr. King, Mr. Rufus King. And he's talking about money and debt. And they use, not in this one, I don't think, but I think in some of these, they kind of reference the old British currency, such as shillings and pence or pennies and so forth. So anyway, let's go ahead and start this over again, because I didn't notice we ran out of time. So let's pick it up from scratch or from the top. Thanks.
This fact is true. The history of our own country is a melancholy proof of a similar truth. Massachusetts has paid while other states have been delinquent. How was the war carried on with the paper money? Requisitions on the states for that money were made. Who paid them? Massachusetts and a few others. A requisition of $29 million were quoted on Massachusetts, and it was paid. This state has paid in her proportion of the old money. How comes it then that gentlemen have any of this money by them? Because the other states have shamefully neglected to pay their quotas. Do you ask for redress? You are scoffed at. The next requisition was for $11 million, $6 million of which were to be paid in facilities, the rest in silver money, for discharging the interest of the national debt. If the legislatures found a difficulty in paying the hard money, why did they not pay the paper? But $1,200,000 have been paid, and six states have not paid a farthing of it. After mentioning another requisition, equally disregarded, Mr. King said, two states have not paid a single farthing from the moment they signed the Confederation to this day. If my documents are to be depended on, and they are open to the inspection of all. Now, sir, what faith is to be put in requisitions on the states for monies to pay our domestic creditors and discharge our foreign debts, for monies lent us in the day of difficulty and distress? Sir, experience proves, as well as anything can be proved, that no dependence can be placed on such requisitions. What method, then, can be devised to compel the delinquent states to pay their quotas? Sir, I know of none. Laws, to be effective, therefore, must not be laid on states, but upon individuals. Sir, it has been objected to the proposed Constitution that the power is too great, and by this Constitution is to be sacred. But if the want of power is the defect in the old Confederation, there is a fitness and propriety in adopting what is here proposed, which gives the necessary power wanted. Congress now have power to call for what monies and in what proportion they please, but they have no authority to compel a compliance therewith. It is an objection in some gentlemen's minds that Congress should possess the power, the purse, and the sword. But, sir, I would ask whether any government can exist or give security to the people which is not possessed of this power. The first revenue will be raised from the impost, to which there is no objection. The next from the excise, and if these are not sufficient, direct taxes must be laid. To conclude, sir, if we mean to support an efficient federal government, which under the old Confederation can never be the case, the proposed Constitution is, in my opinion, the only one that can be substituted.
Now, believe it or not, they actually laid direct taxes rarely. As a matter of fact, what they did, as we know, we'll get into this, they assumed the debt, and meaning that they tried to come up with a different way instead of actually using any direct taxes on the states. What they did was they started selling bonds, and they tried to get people to buy into the American bank and its banking products, which failed. But for the most part, the first tax, because they were laying taxes on imposts, not that they weren't, but the first tax that they that we know about, there were some attempts of taxes, but the first tax that we know about is what? It was an excise tax, and everybody had chafed their skin a little bit, you know. Rubbed them raw.
Was it the Stamp Act?
Well, no, it was the whiskey. The whiskey.
Oh, okay, I got you.
Yes. Anyway, and it took a while. And the reason why, if we read in before, you and I read the bounty acts in Congress, or the bounty debate, and for the cod fishery bounties, and they were trying to figure out how to pay a bounty out, which means it was kind of like a payout to the fisheries, where that's not a tax, it's a handout, it's welfare. And Madison, we know what Madison said about that. But they hadn't at that point yet really laid out any taxes. And at the beginning, Hamilton was trying to come up with a way of taxing, and the real vexing part of the Constitution that Madison would not let him skirt was the uniformity. So one of the first taxes that Hamilton came up with was a tax on the transactions or the sales of horses. And it was quickly pointed out that almost all the horses lived in the southern states, that the northern states, many people lived without them. You know, or they, you know, had a mule or what have you, but not a horse, and that the amount of transactions that would occur on an annual basis would be so disproportionate that it couldn't be uniform. And so he goes, okay, so, well, now what? And that's when he finally came down to distilled liquor, you know, the whiskey tax. And so that became this huge rub because that was considered a staple. Now, I don't know. I'm not insulting you, but you understand what a staple is, right? Not something that holds paper together.
Yes, sir. I was in the Army.
Okay, but people today, you'd be surprised. What's a staple? What are you talking about? Because they don't teach that in school. You got these staples. People kind of, everybody lived on milk and eggs and, you know, the staples of life. And so anyway, I'm sure the staple means something to basically, you know, a fundamental necessity. Anywho, back to...
Like the store, Staples?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a tech store. So that's what I'm saying. Today, the vernacular has kind of shifted. I don't know if kids today even understand what a staple is. That being said, whiskey was, back in those days, not as distilled to the high proof that it is today. It was much more powerful than beer, but it wasn't, you know, 60, 90, or that type of proof. But it was still enough to get easy to get drunk on, more so than wine or anything else. And so it was... the level of distilling or however they did it, it was more for preserving because it was grain. It was grain juice, and it was preserved because obviously the alcohol. So that being said, it was one of those things that got them through the winter days and nights when they couldn't, you know, grow and buy grain to make bread. It was considered a staple. And as a matter of fact, John Adams, a staple in his life was his hard apple cider. If he had a glass of hard apple cider every morning before he, you know, went off to do anything. So it's not that these men were drunkards. And as a matter of fact, you've heard the term caucusing.
Yes.
Do you know what that meant back in those days when they were caucusing?
No, but the way you're talking sounds like it might be fun.
And there was an alcoholic beverage around. So when they were working, just like at the Constitutional Convention or in Continental Congress and so forth, when the Marine Corps was created and when they decided to create the Army and the Navy, they were caucusing at the time. I believe all those ideas were a part of their work in the evening hours, not at the offices of Continental Congress. They were where they were having their dinner and drinks, because they would continue working or caucusing, because that's what they called it. They, let's go caucus over dinner, and they would have, you know, beans and whatever, I don't know, and some brew, and that this is where they had these ideas of, well, let's do this. And so it was Tun's Tavern where they decided to create the Marine Corps. And I don't know the history of the other services, but that was via caucusing, where they were continuing to figure out how to do this and how to fund that and what they could do. Because there was very little they could do. They had very little money. They didn't know what to do. And so I have no idea what they occupied their time with, but I guess, you know, it was tough because you just didn't have any resources. So anyway, so caucusing in those days, and it was one of those things that they kind of maintained. And when you hear states, I don't know, does Louisiana have primaries or do they have caucuses or both?
I believe we have both. If it has anything to do with alcohol, we probably have it.
Yes, of course. Okay. Well, I know Washington State does both caucusing and they have primaries as well. And so caucusing is usually when the parties are, you know, doing their work and so forth, and conventions and all of that. But in most caucuses today, I don't think there's, you know, any alcohol served, because got to remember, the Prohibition period really created the stigma towards alcohol. I mean, this, and, you know, as a matter of fact, you're probably old enough. You remember MADD, M-A-D-D, right? Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the stigma grew and grew. I don't know if you grew up where it wasn't uncommon for somebody in your age group to go out at underage, drinking and driving, and a cop would pull you over and find alcohol in your car, and they would pour the alcohol out and give you a little warning, now don't do that again. And, you know, it was drunk driving, or I should say drinking while intoxicated, was far more acceptable than it is now because of, you know, this zero scorched earth tolerance towards that type of behavior.
Right? Oh, absolutely. And we're famous for go cups and drive through daiquiri shops.
Ah. So open containers in Louisiana is a go. Because I know.
No, they've changed the laws a lot in the last, I'd say, decade or so.
Okay. All right.
But you can still go to a drive-through daiquiri shop, and if the cops pull you over, then your lid has to be still sealed.
Ah, okay.
You know, inspect your cup and see if you've been drinking out of it or whatever.
Yeah.
But you're right. It used to be like just a little, you'll be okay. You'll be on your way.
Yeah, because, you know, People started really, you know, I don't want to say they underestimated, they marginalized, but I think it got to a point where there was just such disregard, or I should say the loss of life was getting to a point where the scorched earth attitude started taking over. And so, you know, that we are now at that point. So let me ask you this. When we look at, is society better for having those types of thresholds, those types of bars of behavior, controlling behavior?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And, there's no doubt about it.
And
the whole designated driver push, and it really has, I mean, I think it's had a profound effect on that paradigm.
Right.
Because I know when I was growing up, you used to be worried when your parents would go out on Friday. You didn't know if they were going to come home or wind up in the ditch, or, you know, it was terrible. There were like tragic accidents every weekend and every time there was any kind of holiday. And I think that's made a big difference. It's really in the front of people's minds when they do imbibe, you know what I mean? They think about designated drivers and how they're going to get home, and they have programs now on certain holidays where you can call the sheriff's office and they'll come give you a ride.
Right.
So I think it's made a really big difference.
Okay. So we kind of talked about this, that's an enlightened society. When society starts creating what would be norms of discipline and standards and those types of things. Now, when society does that, it does it on its own. What we have today, unfortunately, is legislating morality, if that makes sense. Because
I think it's more public safety. Because that's what I was going to say. One of the things that has made an impact on that situation, that topic, is the more stringent punishments for drunk driving and, you know, intoxication. When you get in an accident or something, if you're intoxicated, then there's more of a liability on you. And I think that led to changes in society, to where people are like, okay, I can't afford to have my life destroyed by getting a DUI, so I'm going to have a designated driver, or we're going to rent a party bus, or we're going to do this or do that, because they don't want to face those criminal penalties. And also, you know, they don't want to, you know, kill somebody on the road. And it's just more in the front of people's minds. I don't know if it's legislating morality. I think it's more of a public safety issue.
Well, so when we look at, because it's not just in one little, you know, angle that we're looking here, but when we look at it from a lot of different angles, the justice system itself isn't equal. Because if you're a hot football player, if you know there is a status given to you, we're going to have a tolerance for this person.
Right.
Athletes, stars, you know,
public officials,
there you go, they don't get the same treatment because our justice system has been corrupted. And so when we look at all things, you know, I look at, in the old days, see, Alexis de Tocqueville, was one of his lines that was really famous, or I should say you probably heard, America's great because America was good. He looked to find, you know, where America was great, and it wasn't great in the halls of civics and in the halls of justice, you know, where government and courts were and so forth. He saw America great because America was going to church. He saw America was great because every Sunday the churches were filled, and because people had a moral compass, and because they believed in a greater power. We have lost that. He talked a lot. I mean, I remember reading that book, and I was just, wow, he really used mores to ad nauseum. I mean, I got sick of hearing the word mores. But that was so big in his eyes. It was so different. America was so religious that it was the churches that was actually holding the people at bay. In other words, we didn't need laws necessarily to, you know, go after people. The churches themselves, you know, you would be shamed, and nobody wanted to cross the church because you couldn't just leave. You couldn't just pack up and have, you know, allied van lines come pick you up and take you across the nation. I mean, what went with you would follow you, your reputation, what have you, and it was a small world. There wasn't, you know, you just couldn't just, like I said, being mobile like we are today was, you know, almost unheard of. We were all stuck in our circumstances. This is where my family grew up, and this is my land. I just can't leave this land because I'm not paying taxes. I mean, in those days, you owned your land. So people had to, because it just wasn't worth throwing their life away. In other words, they had to maintain this discipline. And this, I think there were a lot of these little different factors, but for the most part, it really was because of the moral character of America. And it was that internal disciplining more so than necessarily creating laws. Now, you've seen Minority Report, probably.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And that's where a cognitive, you know, group of, you know, people that with these special cognitive powers could predict that you're going to commit a crime, and they come and arrest you. That's going one step. That's taking it to a completely different level, to where you don't even commit the crime. And what's interesting that I point out to people is, if you remember the movie, it starts off with this guy coming home, finding his wife committing adultery with another man. And he's going to go kill them. Now, in every state in the Union, when that movie came out, it was still legal in every state in the Union to kill your spouse and lover in the heat of the moment, almost I believe, in every state in the Union. If not almost every state in the Union, that was still a legal crime of passion. Interesting, right? Because they're depicting it as completely unacceptable when, you know, your whole life has been just completely destroyed by somebody you've loved and trusted and blah, blah, blah. So the point is where they, you know, these things are done in challenging and breaking paradigms and getting people to, you know, say, wow, you know, somebody shouldn't be killed because they did such a bad thing. Back in those days, you, as a matter of fact, who was the justice? I know you looked it up. Remember who the justice was that went into bankruptcy court? Thrown off the bench for the period that they went into bankruptcy court.
Wasn't it Wilson?
Yes, it was. James Wilson, yes. That's right. And that was just one of those things. I mean, if you stole a horse, or if you thieved to a degree that, you know, something was so valuable, like when Thomas Jefferson's facsimiles were stolen, those two guys that stole them, they were hanged. So capital punishment was, you know, so they did have a high threshold, but they didn't have hangings on a regular basis. But again, there were things that were happening that at that point in time, I think, you know, and I don't know, I can't be the clairvoyant here, but I do know that society didn't allow misinformation or evil things to exist. I mean, when something really bad came into the library, they would get rid of it. Back in those days, and I don't think it was a matter of censorship. I think it was just a matter of safety for, you know, keeping evil at bay. So I didn't mean to take the whole morning or the whole early segment and just talking about, you know, this, but because I was talking about these taxes and what they had to do and so forth, and we went down this track of this discipline of what we had to do. But anyway, when we come back, I'll try to make sense of this and so we can move on. Forgive me for taking so much time. We'll be right back, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
I find it fascinating. This is one of the reasons why I go down these rat holes. And again, I don't mean to do this, but we just spent the whole morning segment after just reading this. And it all really started because we were talking about this concept of the direct taxes and actually the whiskey tax on excise taxes and the mores and how we kind of shifted and brought in this discipline concept. One of the things that we still haven't gotten as a society, if we're going to become an enlightened society again, I think that we need to get back to some of the things. And one of those things that the framers had a very good a foundation on, and it was being citizens of their church, citizens of Christianity, if that makes sense, because they lived as ambassadors of their faith, regardless of the faith it was, whether it was the Puritan faith, the Anglican faith, they were ambassadors, they were not hypocrites, and this is what I believe Alexis de Tocqueville saw. But many people didn't understand the onus because at that point in time, the onus of being a citizen in the United States, they didn't have to feel like they were ambassadors because there weren't people that were literally out to destroy America amongst them. We look today and we can easily see the Democratic Party is an organization, a political organization operating to destroy our constitutional republic. And nobody even makes the connection that how is it that they are citizens anymore? They should lose their citizenship. The stigma of losing your citizenship or your membership of a church back 200 years ago would just crush you. It just wasn't worth it. And all the other consequences. I mean, people, you know, looked and they said, life's not worth those types of pains and sorrows. And maybe they were, I don't know. I don't think it was necessarily simple. I just think that there are a lot of different factors. And I just look at how we today, because of our tolerance and allowance to allow evil to just set up, we are not required. As a matter of fact, I think the scriptures, the New Testament warns us not to allow evil to live in our home, not to allow it in our home, in our minds, in where we abide. So we've got a lot of problems, but when we look at what they were talking about in these taxes, America didn't need, and today, America does not need probably much excise taxes because we seem to be the consumers of so much coming into America. We stopped using imposts. When I say we started subsidizing communism around the world, when we started buying their crap where they actually had all of these extra taxes, whether it be the VAT tax of Europe or what have you, where we started subsidizing, you know, the German, or not the German, you know, the German government, the Japanese government, the Chinese government, and they're added on cost to the products that they were bringing in, because it was all basically government functions of corporations. There is this incestuous relationship, and even today, there's this incestuous relationship with all corporations. It wasn't so much so in America. It started, but it was a rule of thumb, or I should say it was just a matter of fact in Japan. Same thing with Germany. Same thing with everywhere around the world except for America. And when we stopped charging impost on their products, then we literally started, that was the beginning of making it, of subsidizing, giving them the ability to become more free with socialism or growing their socialistic states and so forth. And actually, we've been even more proactive and more direct in subsidizing communism. But my point is it was interesting how he made these points. Two states didn't pay at all, and that there had to be this compelling of pain. But the point was that they needed to get to a point where they could actually pay or actually go down the impost, because Continental Congress didn't have the ability to create imposts. They weren't importing things. They didn't have the ability to lay impost as well as excise, as well as some of these other taxes. So anyway, hopefully, this going down this idea of how do we get to a point of enlightenment? Because, folks, if we really want to start seeing changes, we have to be the center. We have to be the key to the change we want to see. We have to be that ambassador as a good American citizen. We have to be that ambassador as a Christian. We have to be an ambassador of all things good, and using discipline and, avoiding hypocrisy, those types of things. But anyway, I won't digress again, at least not until we read something else. And the next thing we're going to actually read is this line, or I should say this note on commerce. And this is by Mr. Dawes. So let's go ahead and dive into this. And I think this is where we talk about China again. We've already talked
as to commerce. It is well known that the different states now pursue different systems of duties in regard to each other. By this, and for want of general laws of prohibition through the Union, we have not secured even our own domestic traffic that passes from state to state. This is contrary to the policy of every nation on earth. Some nations have no other commerce. The great and nourishing empire of China has but little commerce beyond her own territories, and no country is better circumstanced than we for an exclusive traffic from state to state. Yet even in this, we are rivaled by foreigners, by those foreigners to whom we are the least indebted. A vessel from Roseway or Halifax finds as hearty a welcome with its fish and whalebone at the southern ports as though it was built, navigated, and freighted from Salem or Boston. And this must be the case until we have laws comprehending and embracing alike all the states in the Union. But it is not only our coasting trade. Our whole commerce is going to ruin. Congress has not had power to make even a trade law which shall confine the importation of foreign goods to the ships of the producing or consuming country. If we had such a law, we should not go to England for the goods of other nations, nor would British vessels be the carriers of American produce from our sister states. In the states southward of the Delaware, it is agreed that 3/4 of the produce are exported and 3/4 of the returns are made in British bottoms. It is said that for exporting timber, 1/2 the property goes to the carrier, and of the produce in general, it has been computed that when it is shipped for London from a southern state to the value of $1,000,000, the British merchant draws from that sum $300,000 under the names of freight and charges. This is money which belongs to the New England states, because we can furnish the ships as well as, and much better than, the British. Our sister states are willing that we should receive these benefits and that they should be secured to us by national laws. But until this is done, Their private merchants will, no doubt, for the sake of loan credit or some other such temporary advantage, prefer the ships of foreigners, and yet we have suffered these ignominious burdens rather than trust our own representatives with power to help us. And we call ourselves free and independent states. We are independent of each other, but we are slaves to Europe. We have no uniformity in duties, imposts, excises, or prohibitions. Congress has no authority to withhold advantages from foreigners in order to obtain advantages from them. By the ninth of the old articles, Congress may enter into treaties and alliances under certain provisos, but Congress cannot pledge that a single state shall not render the whole treaty of commerce a nullity.
So when Trump started putting out these imposts and how everybody started, you know, bellowing and crying and going, this is just wrong. It goes to, you know, that was a primary source of income and revenue for the United States. And this idea of free trade, yeah, free trade amongst the states. No free trade with another nation. And so that argument has already been read already here, but I think it was just another reiteration of the exact same argument that under the Articles of Confederation, they were not a union. When you look at the Constitution and the way it kind of merged everybody together, maintained autonomy, maintained their independence, and so forth, but when you look at what the Constitution did in contrast to the economic union that, and as a matter of fact, the economic union is, I think, probably the third iteration of Europe trying to unify. They're just not willing to do it. They're just not willing to, and they don't want to give a government like and I don't want to call it a federal government, a general government, the ability to do these very few things. We're not talking about, but, you know, they're not willing to merge themselves. They're not willing to go that far where, you know, their foreign trade and their national defense is all consolidated. What would Europe be like if they did what we did with the Constitution?
I don't think they'd like it.
Well, see, so their problem was that they weren't going to give up their kings. They weren't going to give up their religious differences. They were not willing, and in America, we had those same problems, but the difference was we were willing to put aside our differences and our self-interest, and we humbled ourselves and bound ourselves into this union. And if you really look, it's not a lot. They're not surrendering a lot, only that anything to do with foreign trade goes through the general government. War goes through the general government. And so what else is there? Or national security, those types of concerns. It's not like the general government, the federal government, controls what you make or how you make it or anything like that. When we look at the powers that they have, in contrast to the powers they're executing, because the powers they're executing is unlimited, but those aren't legitimate powers. Those are assumed powers, unconstitutional, or better yet, usurped powers. So anyway, so Europe could have done this. They could have done it. They were just not willing to, you know, put aside those differences in their self-interest, really. So when we look at this next one, the convention, they kind of dive into, you know, what comes out of this. So let's go ahead and take this little commentary from General Thompson.
Mr. President, I totally abhor this paragraph. Massachusetts has ever been a leading state. Now let her give good advice to her sister states. Suppose 9 states adopt this constitution. Who shall touch the other 4? Some cry out, force them. I say, draw them. We love liberty. Britain never tried to enslave us until she told us we had too much liberty. The Confederation wants amendments. Shall we not amend it? The convention were sent on to Philadelphia to amend this Confederation. but they made a new creature, and the very setting out of its of it is unconstitutional. In the convention, Pennsylvania had more members than all New England, and two of our delegates were only persuaded to sign the Constitution. Massachusetts once shut up the harbors against the British. There, I confess, I was taken in. Don't let us be in a hurry again. Let us wait to see what our sister states will do. What shall we suffer if we adjourn the consideration of it for 5 or 6 months? It is better to do this than to adopt it so hastily. Take care we don't disunite the states.
Yes.
By uniting we stand, by dividing we fall.
Yeah, and so this is a this comment or comments just like this come out because they're trying to say, let's not do this. As a matter of fact, we haven't gotten there yet, but somebody actually comes right out and says, we don't need the rest of these states. We did just fine on our own. We fought most all the war for ourselves. And had it been, you know, all equal, then, we don't need them. I mean, that language starts coming out. So let's go down to the delegated powers on the next day by Judge Sumner.
The powers proposed to be delegated in this section are very important, as they will, in effect, place the purse strings of the citizens in the hands of Congress for certain purposes. In order to know whether such powers are necessary, we ought, sir, to inquire what the design of uniting under one government is. It is that the national dignity may be supported, its safety preserved, and necessary debts paid. It is not necessary, then, to afford the means by which alone those objects can be attained. Much better, it appears to me, would it be for the states not to unite under one government, which will be attended with some expense, than to unite and at the same time withhold the powers necessary to accomplish the design of the Union. Gentlemen say, the power to raise money may be abused. I grant it, and the same may be said of any other delegated power. Our general court had the same power, but did they ever dare abuse it? Instead of voting themselves 6 shillings a day, they might vote themselves £12 a day. But there never was a complaint of their voting themselves more than what was reasonable. If they should make an undue use of their power, they know a loss of confidence in the people would be the consequence, and they would not be reelected. And this is one security in the hands of the people.
Okay, so that right there is shillings and pennies. The D is actually a penny, believe it or not, and so a pence. Let's jump down to the impost and direct taxes. It is down on January 23rd. Impost and direct taxes. You see that one after Mr. Pierce?
Yes, sir.
Let's do that one.
But, Mr. President, if Congress have the powers of direct taxes in the manner prescribed in this section, I feel we shall have that mode of taxation adopted in preference to imposts and excises. And the reasons of my fears are these. When the imposts are granted to Congress in this state, I, then being a member of court, well remember the gentleman in trade, almost with one consent, agreed that it was an unequal tax, bearing hard on them. For although it finally was a tax on the consumer, yet in the first instance it was paid by persons in trade, and also that they consumed more than the landed interest of dutied articles, and noting nothing but necessity induced them to submit to grant said imposts, as that was the only way Congress could collect money to pay the foreign debt. Under the regulation they were then under, and I fear part of this state's members in Congress, when this Constitution is adopted, will resume their own opinion. When they can lay direct taxes, and as Rhode Island has always been against an impost, and as they have an equal representation in the Senate, and part of Connecticut will be interested with them, and the southern states having no manufacturers of their own and consuming much more foreign articles than the northern, it appears to me we are not certain of availing ourselves of an impost. if we give Congress the power to levy and collect direct taxes in time of peace.
Okay. So he kind of points out, and I think it was Rhode Island and Connecticut, the two states that didn't pay their taxes. And he talks about the southern states not manufacturing their own. Well, manufacturing was done in the Northeast. That's where the factories started beginning. The manufacturing of shoes and those types of goods were very, very prevalent up there. Anyway, so he goes a little bit further, and now he dives into what we call here jurisdiction. So let's go into this one.
While I am up, Mr. President, I would make some observations on what has been passed over, as I think it is within the orders of the House. The Honorable Mr. Sedgwick said, if I understood him right, that if he thought that this Constitution consolidated the union of the states, he should be the last man that should vote for it. But I take his meaning to be this. According to the reasoning of Mr. Ames, that it is not a consolidation of the union because there are three branches in the union, and therefore it is not a consolidation of the union. But, sir, I think I cannot conceive of a sovereignty of power existing within a sovereign power, nor do I wish anything in this Constitution to prevent Congress being sovereign in matters belonging to their jurisdiction. For I have seen the necessity of their powers in almost all the instances that have been mentioned in this convention. And also last winter in the rebellion, I thought it would be better for Congress to have stilled the people rather than the people from amongst themselves, who are more apt to be governed by temper than others. As it appeared to me, we were in the disqualifying act, as in my opinion, we then did not keep strictly to our own Constitution. And I believe such a superior power ought to be in Congress. But I would have it distinctly bounded that everyone may know the utmost limits of it. And I have some doubts on my mind as to those limits, which I wish to have solved. I have also an objection as to the term for which the Senate are to be in office. For as the democratical branch of the federal legislature is to continue in office 2 years, and they are the only check on the federal, and they, the Senate, to continue in office 6 years, they will have an undue influence on the democratic branch. And I think they ought not to continue in office for a longer time than the other. And also that if they conduct ill, we may have a constitutional revolution in as short a period as 2 years, if needed. The Honorable Mr. King said some days past that the Senate going out by classes, if rightly considered, were not four but four years, because one third part was never more than six, another four, and a third two. Therefore, the medium was four. But I think that way of arguing would argue that if they were all to go out at the end of 6 years, that they were but 3 years in office, because half their time they were under the age of 3 years, and the other half over the age of 3 years in office. Therefore, his arguing to me in that respect was not well-founded.
Do you kind of understand what he was talking about regarding the Senate and the classes?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, good. Good. All right, so now he references Fisher Ames, and he references King. Now, Colonel Varnum talks a bit about delegated power.
In an answer to an inquiry why a Bill of Rights was not annexed to this Constitution, said that by the Constitution of Massachusetts, the legislature have a right to make all laws not repugnant to the Constitution. Now, said he, if there is such a clause in the Constitution under consideration, then there would be a necessity for a Bill of Rights. In the section under debate, Congress have an express power to levy taxes, etc., and to pass laws to carry their requisitions into execution. This, he said, was express and required no Bill of Rights. After stating the difference between delegated power and the grant of all power, except in certain cases, the colonel proceeded to controvert the idea that this Constitution went to a consolidation of the Union. He said it was only a consolidation of strength, and that it was apparent Congress had no right to alter the internal relations of a state. The design in amending the Confederation, he said, was to remedy its defects. It was the interest of the whole to confederate against a foreign enemy, and each was bound to exert its utmost ability to oppose that enemy. But it had been done at our expense in a great measure, and there was no way to provide for a remedy, because Congress had not the power to call forth the resources of every state, nor to coerce delinquent states. He showed the necessity of Congress being a... And, oh, why did I skip all of that?
I don't know. You just paused and I go, did you just lose your place?
Government, okay. I guess it was the highlighting. Under the proposed government, those states which will not comply with equal requisitions will be coerced. And this, he said, is a glorious provision. In the late war, said the colonel, the states of New Hampshire and Massachusetts for 2 or 3 years had in the field half the Continental Army under General Washington. Who paid those troops? The states which raised them and were called on to pay them. How, unless a Congress have a power to levy taxes, can they make the states pay their proportion? In order that this and some other states may not again to be obliged to pay 8 or 10 times their proportion of the public exigencies, he said. He said this power is highly necessary to be delegated to the federal head. He showed the necessity of Congress being enabled to prepare against the attacks of a foreign enemy. And he called upon the gentleman from Andover, Mr. Sims, or any other gentleman, to produce an instant where any government consisting of 3 branches elected by the people and having checks on each other, as this has, abused the power to abused the power delegated to them.
Okay, so one of the things that was highlighted that I just want to go back, because, and I say this, because as I do presentations and as I'm working through bad paradigms of Republicans and so forth, I mean, you know, we talk a lot, and at least recently we've been talking a lot about admitting states into the union, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And so this must be, I'll just say, magnified to its fullest, this one line. That he says that it was apparent Congress had no power or no right, not no power, no right to alter the internal relations of a state. So I'm highlighting this. This is just one of many times and many ways it was stated. The federal government could not come in and dismantle your church. They couldn't get involved at all regarding the establishment of a church. They couldn't change your politics. They couldn't force politics upon you. Or the threshold was you had to be Republican in form, and that bar was very low. I can't emphasize this enough. And when we look today, nobody even questions when the federal government says, you can't do this anymore, states. What? Where did they get that authority? They have no authority to be meddling within these types of affairs within the state. And so I just wanted to make sure I highlighted that before we jumped into, you know, more discussion over the delegated powers. And we'll hit that tomorrow, folks. Just keep in mind that these right here are literally, they're literally laying out the stipulations and definitions of the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.